Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Nichols of The Nation magazine, who examines how the massive union solidarity mobilization in Madison may provoke a political realignment in Wisconsin and perhaps the nation. Environmental activist Tim DeChristopher, who discusses why he took direct action to derail the sale of public land to private oil and gas developers, an act for which he now faces 10 years in prison. And Colleen Rowley, former FBI special agent and 9/11 whistleblower, who decries the degrading treatment of Army Private Bradley Manning, accused of leaking secret government documents to WikiLeaks. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Iraq, recent anti-government street protests, inspired by the uprisings in Egypt and Tunisia, were met by a severe crackdown by security forces and the alleged torture of activists and journalists. One of the most intense confrontations took place in late February, when several thousand young people marched in Baghdad's Tahrir Square. As the protesters tried to enter the highly protected Green Zone, the location of most government offices and the U.S. Embassy, Iraqi security forces fired live ammunition into the crowd and used tear gas to break up the protest. 27 people have been reported killed in clashes with security forces, and dozens of activists and journalists have been arrested. Many protesters are angry with blatant corruption under current Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Iraqi human rights activist Salam Mohammed al-Segar told the Washington Post, "Maliki is starting to act like Saddam Hussein, to use the same fear, to plant it inside Iraqis who criticize him." In recent weeks, many Sunni neighborhoods, who mostly oppose Maliki, were blockaded by security forces and prevented from joining recent pro-democracy protests. On February 20th, police launched a late-night raid to break up a peaceful protest by human rights activists and journalists in Tahrir Square. Police stabbed numerous protesters, some of whom were sleeping at the time. The Washington Post reported that one journalist was arrested, beaten, and subjected to electric shock, but U.S. soldiers stationed at an Iraqi army base did nothing to intervene. Human rights activists are blasting a new textile trade agreement between the European Union and the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan as a tacit endorsement of child labor. Uzbekistan, the world's third largest exporter of cotton, has come under increased civil criticism for using school-aged children to pick cotton by hand during harvest season instead of going to school. The Uzbek cotton crop is a vital national priority and a source of foreign exchange for the poor country. The government of President Islam Karimov denies this use of forced labor in picking cotton, but has never allowed the International Labor Organization inside the country to monitor child labor. The new trade agreement was announced in the aftermath of a controversial visit to Brussels by President Karimov in early February. The agreement grants Uzbekistan tariff and customs privileges in the EU marketplace. Rachel Dunbar of Human Rights Watch told the Interpress Service the new trade deal, quote, "certainly makes previous statements of concern by the EU over the use of child labor in Uzbekistan ring very hollow indeed." According to UNICEF, over 1 million children in Uzbekistan pick the cotton crop each year. With a push for a new trade agreement, civil society groups are increasing their calls in Europe to ban the importation of Uzbek cotton, which is primarily used to make clothing sold in Europe. Conservatives are pushing ahead on their cultural war on Islam by promoting legislation that bans Sharia law. This follows last fall's campaign against Park 51, the mosque and cultural center several blocks from Ground Zero in New York City. One of the most extreme anti-Sharia bills is in Tennessee. It makes it a felony to follow Sharia, the core religious principles of Islam. The bill also criminalizes material support for a Sharia organization, defined as two people conspiring to support Sharia law in any state in the United States. The bill was drafted by right-wing lawyer David Yerushalmi, who backed foes of New York City's Park 51 project and is a self-proclaimed Sharia expert. Less well-known is Yerushalmi's association with white separatists. According to Mother Jones magazine, he is the founder of the Society of Americans for National Existence, or SANE. In a 2006 essay on the SANE website, Yerushalmi asserted that whites are genetically superior to blacks and more supportive of democratic norms. Despite his racist rantings, Yerushalmi has won praise from right-wing opinion journals like the National Review and the Washington Times. Abed Awad, an authority on Islamic law, says the Tennessee bill would criminalize core Muslim practices like praying five times a day and donating money to the poor. And civil liberties advocates maintain that the bill violates core values of the U.S. Constitution. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
The fight over Wisconsin public employee unions' collective bargaining rights continued into a fourth week in Wisconsin after Republican Governor Scott Walker and 14 Democratic senators who left the state to deny the Senate a quorum could not find common ground for negotiations. Although unions agreed to all of the governor's proposed salary, health insurance, and pension cuts to address the state's $137 million budget gap, thus far, Walker has refused to back down on his demand to take away most state employees' collective bargaining rights. Other provisions of Walker's budget repair bill include preventing unions from collecting dues through payroll deductions and requiring unions to hold annual recertification votes. Civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson and award-winning filmmaker Michael Moore were among the well-known progressive activists to come to Wisconsin to cheer on the tens of thousands of pro-union demonstrators who have organized daily rallies at the Capitol in Madison and across the state. In his speech, Moore stated that the protests in Wisconsin and other states had awoken a sleeping giant known as the working people, and that this is our last chance to wrestle America away from the grubby hands of the greedy rich. As Wisconsin and national polls find that Walker's and other GOP governors' anti-union policies are unpopular, efforts are underway to collect enough signatures to initiate a recall election against 8 pro-Walker Republican state senators. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Nichols, national correspondent with The Nation magazine, who lives in Madison. He discusses how the massive solidarity mobilization in Madison may be changing Wisconsin's and possibly the nation's political alignment.
The Democratic senators have said from the start that they don't intend to stay in Illinois forever, that they hope to come back at some point. They just simply want to have a negotiation where they establish some core ground rules for how to approach these issues and hopefully to have an honest vote on it. They would also, of course, prefer a genuine negotiation where the governor might accept some modest changes to at least allow unions to maintain their collective bargaining rights. The unions have accepted giving up a lot of their economic demands, and so the governor would certainly get a lot of what he's asking for from a fiscal standpoint. He'd get givebacks on pay, on benefits, and on pension, actually more than I would like to see them give up. But the unions are ironclad and very, very firm that they want to retain their collective bargaining rights, their right to speak in the workplace.
John Nichols, with this enormous outpouring of solidarity for public labor unions in Wisconsin, do you see signs of a political culture change in the state of Wisconsin and maybe by extension to the rest of the country as a result of what's happening there?
Well, Scott, that's a very, very good question. And I've certainly got my romantic side. I am open to the possibility that we have reached the pivot point. That's something that Michael Moore said when he was here on Saturday, that, you know, we finally reached the point where a great mass of Americans are ready to stand up and say, we've had it. We're just not going to take anymore. You shuttered our factories. You foreclosed on our homes. You've deindustrialized and made dysfunctional our communities. Now you're coming after our public sector jobs and our last hope of remaining middle class, and we're just not going to take it anymore. And I think that's a credible argument. We're early in the stages of this fight, and we always run the risk of people becoming disenchanted and frustrated. But what I can tell you is, at least in Wisconsin, the poll numbers suggest that among union households, these are working-class families, that had been tending toward conservative voting patterns, These would be your Reagan Democrats or your what's the matter with Kansas type folks, the ones who seemingly vote against their own economic interests. There's simply been huge movement, according to all the polls, in these communities, among these people. And that movement does suggest the possibility of a fundamental political change. If much larger portion of the working class, of blue-collar workers and pink-collar workers, begin to vote their core economic interests as their first priority, not perhaps their attitude about abortion or their attitude about gay rights or something like that, if their economic interests become preeminent in their voting choices, then the state of Wisconsin becomes a very, very liberal Democratic state. And, intriguingly enough, if you translate that to other states, the same thing begins to happen. The real factor in our politics over the last 30 years, the better part of 30 years, has been that a substantial portion of our blue-collar and pink-collar workers have voted for Republicans who, frankly, are not friends of their economic interests, but who may give them something in another sphere, a social or cultural reward of some sort of rhetoric on issues of concern to the religious right. If we're breaking that down, if we're moving beyond that, then for the first time in decades, we are seeing the possibility of a politics that's rooted in some populist, progressive ideals about the economy that could change a lot, maybe everything. That's certainly what excites people. I think we're still at an early stage, and we ought to be realistic about it. But I like to think that that we're moving in the right direction. And I can tell you, as somebody who covers politics very, very seriously, I haven't had this kind of sense of a change, of a understanding of the essential role of economics in our politics in my lifetime. I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen so many people learning the lyrics to old labor songs or clenching their fist and shouting an injury to one is an injury to all. I mean, things we don't see in America very often are happening every day in Wisconsin.
As you see national labor leaders come to Madison, Wisconsin, do you have a sense that the labor unions are looking at this moment in Madison, Wisconsin as a spark that could light up a prairie fire and reverse the fortunes of labor if they play their cards right in this once-in-a-generation moment?
Yeah, I think you can start to see the building out of a much more muscular labor movement in this country, but it can't be delinked from broader movements. And if the labor movement becomes far less apologetic, far more aggressive, yeah, I think this could be a transitional moment. But it's not easy. It's not like, wow, you know, somebody's saying solidarity forever, now it's all going to come together. We have to recognize it as a multi-layered, complex struggle, but one where something remarkable has been revealed to us, and that is that the American people are more on the side of labor than I think even most labor leaders thought, that there really is a reservoir of sympathy and support for the trade union movement and recognition of its value. And if there was ever a time to move, I think this is it.
That was John Nichols, national correspondent with The Nation magazine. Read his articles online at thenation.com. On March 3rd, Tim DeChristopher was convicted by a federal jury in Salt Lake City, Utah, on two felony counts of interfering with a government auction in December 2008 and making false statements when he placed bids at the auction. DeChristopher had the winning bid on several parcels of land comprising thousands of acres that were being opened for oil and gas drilling during the last days of the outgoing Bush administration. In his bid, he won the rights to 22,500 acres out of 116,000 acres up for auction. DeChristopher said he took the more radical step of becoming a bidder rather than just protesting outside the auction because he wanted to make a stronger statement against the environmental destruction, exacerbating climate change, that would be a byproduct of the extraction of oil and possibly natural gas from the desert near priceless icons like Arches National Park. 29-year-old DeChristopher faces up to 10 years in prison and a fine of $750,000 at his June 23rd sentencing. He hasn't yet decided whether to appeal. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with DeChristopher about his nonviolent direct action and about the organization he co-founded, Peaceful Uprising, to encourage others to take similar risks to combat the climate crisis and build a just, healthy world.
I was going in there with some kind of intention to wave a red flag about what was going on and try to delay the auction long enough that the new administration could reconsider and hopefully reverse the auction, which is eventually what happened. So I was just going in there with that vague intention, not knowing what that might look like if I was going to make a speech or yell something or something like that. And just when I walked in, they asked me if I wanted to be a bidder.
What happened next?
Well, they stopped the auction after I won about 12 parcels in a row. They stopped it, and an agent came over and asked me to step outside. And I told them exactly what I was doing and why, and they took me into custody. They didn't arrest me at the time, but they took me into custody and questioned me for a few hours before releasing me that afternoon.
When were you charged then?
Well, I wasn't charged until almost 4 months later, I think in part because it took them a long time to figure out if I actually broke any laws. But it was actually after the auction was reversed that I was indicted.
So I want to be sure I understand this. Was the auction reversed because it was tainted by your participation or because the Obama administration had decided they didn't really want to be auctioning off the drilling rights in those parcels?
The latter. I mean, it was once they had taken a second look at the auction, the government admitted that they weren't following their own laws in the first place. And the auction itself was illegitimate to begin with.
So when that happened, did you feel like you were off the hook?
I thought it was possible, but I also realized that in some ways it made it more likely for me to be indicted.
Tim DeChristopher, you had considered using the necessity defense, that is, that you took action to prevent a greater harm, which would have been the despoiling of these lands and the contribution to climate change if they were developed for oil drilling. But you weren't able to do that, right?
In the trial, we weren't allowed to say anything that didn't happen on December 19th. So we weren't allowed to let the jury know that the auction was overturned afterwards because the government admitted it was illegitimate. We weren't allowed to let the jury know that I did, in fact, raise the money in the weeks after the auction to make the initial payment, and we offered that to the BLM, and they refused to take it. The jury never heard any of that information. So the verdict was kind of a foregone conclusion by the time that it actually happened.
Tell me again exactly what were the charges?
It was one count of violating the Federal Onshore Oil and Gas Leasing Reform Act, and one count of making false statements.
What were the false statements? You won the bids and you were going to pay for them.
Well, they said that the false statement was the fact that I signed the bidder registration form, which said that I was a bona fide bidder, and they said that at the time that I signed it, I didn't have the intention to actually purchase and develop any of these oil leases. It was interesting in the trial, during cross-examination when I was on the stand, the prosecutors asked if I was bidding in good faith. And I said, could you define in good faith? And he said, well, it means you are a bona fide bidder. And I said, can you define bona fide in this application? And he said, I withdraw the question. And he changed the subject and talked about something else.
You co-founded a group called Peaceful Uprising, which is focused specifically around climate change. Can you explain its goals?
It's something that was set up shortly after the auction with a lot of folks that came together and had heard about what had happened and wanted to encourage similar kind of actions.
Has that happened?
There's certainly been a lot of folks who have expressed their sentiments to me about how they've been affected by this story, and a lot of folks that have come together and built a really strong community of folks who all share that sentiment that we need to be taking stronger action to defend a livable future. And I think the trial and the events surrounding it really galvanized that community a lot. And I think it was an important point for the folks in Peaceful Uprising to make that very public statement outside of the courthouse that whatever happens to me, they're going to respond with joy and resolve, and they're going to keep fighting for a livable future, and they're not going to back down in the face of this attempted intimidation.
That was Tim DeChristopher, an environmental activist who's facing 10 years in prison for placing false bids in a government auction of oil and gas leases. For more information, visit his group's website at peacefuluprising.org. Army Private First Class Bradley Manning stands accused by the U.S. government of being the source of 260,000 diplomatic government cables, more than 90,000 intelligence reports, later distributed to the press by WikiLeaks. After being arrested in Iraq in May 2010 and transferred back to the U.S. in July, the Army intelligence analyst has been held in solitary confinement at the Marine Corps brig in Quantico, Virginia, undergoing a mental health evaluation and awaiting pretrial hearings. In early March, military prosecutors filed an additional 22 charges against Private Manning, including allegations that he aided the enemy, which could carry the death penalty. Manning's lawyer, David E. Coombs, complained that his client was stripped of his clothes and left naked in his prison cell for 7 hours on March 2nd. In a press release, Coombs stated, "This type of degrading treatment is inexcusable and without justification. No other detainee at the brig is forced to endure this type of isolation and humiliation." Ohio Democratic Congressman Dennis Kucinich, who has requested to meet with Manning to investigate allegations of mistreatment, said that despite the fact that Manning has not been found guilty of any crime, he has been kept in isolation 23 out of 24 hours every day, conditions which may violate his Eighth Amendment protection from cruel and unusual punishment. A Pentagon press secretary stated that the conditions under which Manning is being held relate to the seriousness of the charges he's facing and to protect him from potential harm. David House, who has visited Manning in the brig, reports that isolation has severely deteriorated his friend's mental condition, but that there is no indication of suicidal behavior. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who in May 2002 wrote a memo describing some of the FBI's pre-9/11 failures and was named one of Time magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002. She decries the treatment Bradley Manning is being subjected to and her concern about the government's treatment of all whistleblowers.
Well, I don't know much more than what's been reported by his lawyer and a couple of news sites, but it seems that since he was charged with these 22 extra charges, including the capital offense, that he could technically face the death penalty, that every night he's been stripped naked, and not only stripped naked to sleep, but then also made to apparently stand the next morning in front of others. It strikes me as very degrading and almost reminiscent of Abu Ghraib. Forced nudity was the very first step on that whole spectrum of steps that progressed. And I'm very worried that this seems like it's migrated now from places like Abu Ghraib, where we attributed that abuse to a few bad apples, the rogue officers, and now there's an entire Marine brig in Quantico that is practicing something very similar.
The military, through their spokespeople, have responded by saying there are some very critical reasons why he's being stripped naked. They intimate that he may be suicidal and could use clothing to hang himself in his cell and such. But we have Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio demanding informations and explanations. And I know he's pointed out that people in this country are presumed innocent until proven guilty, and that on the face of it, forcing a prisoner to stand naked in their cell for many hours at a time violates the Eighth Amendment of protection from cruel and unusual punishment.
Exactly. And it seems to me that if a congressman requests to ascertain for himself these conditions, that seems very reasonable. You know, we're only hearing it from the Pentagon side. I have some background myself. It's just a coincidence that in the FBI, we got sued once for a jail suicide. And so I actually had to do a lot of research on jail suicides. And while that is certainly a problem and there's a certain profile, et cetera, Bradley Manning has not even been judged by mental health professionals to be in that condition. And that's the real nub here, is that the mental health consultants were not the ones who put this suicide watch on. At one point, about 2.5 weeks ago, the Marine brig officials admitted that the mental health professionals recommended he be off the suicide watch. And the other thing, of course, is in terms of killing yourself with your underwear, if he has a blanket, whatever, there would be other ways. And certainly if he's under supervision, if he's being actually watched, that this wouldn't be possible. So this really does seem like a pretext. I don't understand why Dennis Kucinich or some other independent person is not allowed to even ascertain this for themselves.
Well, let me ask you this, Colleen Raleigh. How does the treatment of Bradley Manning, accused of leaking the WikiLeaks documents, how does that fit in with a trend that you yourself are seeing of the treatment or the maltreatment of whistleblowers in various levels of government, from federal to state and local?
Well, I may have been one of the very last whistleblowers who was able to finish and get to retirement eligibility, and, of course, even got my picture on the Time magazine. It was kind of a shining moment there. Unfortunately, what people don't know is that my disclosures about some of the weaknesses and mistakes made about 9/11, none of that was addressed. There was this, almost a certain amount of leverage gained by, at the time it was President Bush, over the directors, because everybody was trying to hush up these mistakes. And so the directors, of course, were afraid to speak out when Bush said we were going to attack Iraq, and you really have an entwining of horrendous, terrible mistakes. You get Obama into power, and everybody thinks, oh, he's promised that he will increase transparency in government, that he will protect whistleblowers, and certainly when he was campaigning, he was on the side of pointing out these illegalities and problems that were going on. Well, he gets into power, and he's almost doubled down on what he said he would do, which is help whistleblowers. He's prosecuting like three times the number of whistleblowers that were ever prosecuted in 30 years before him. There's one guy in the National Security Administration, former, who revealed fraud, waste, and abuse, and he's facing 15 years. And so what they're trying to do, I think, is set an example to anyone in government who sees something, you know, bad. Of course, I hate to, you know, you hate to imagine that this could happen, but if you're in a situation where you're certainly in one of these torture situations like General Taguba, who was supposed to be investigating, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to, you know, not follow illegal orders. You are supposed to report these things. And yet, if you do, you are going to be retaliated against. And in some cases, if you try to report and everybody covers it up and you try then to go public, you're going to actually be prosecuted now for leaking. It's really bad. It's very, very disappointing to see this happening in the Obama administration.
That was Colleen Raleigh, a former FBI special agent and 9/11 whistleblower. Learn more about the Manning case at bradleymanning.org and courage2resist.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.